Today on Let's Talk, where's your A game? Welcome to Let's Talk. I'm Brian Bielanski. This is the podcast where I talk with interesting people about interesting things. My guest this week, Brittany Wagner. She was featured on the Netflix docuseries Last Chance U, which followed top-ranked junior college football team East Mississippi Community College. She was the Lions Athletics Academic Counselor. Brittany helped students, athletes move beyond personal failures to find success and prepare themselves for life beyond the gridiron. That success led to her new book, Last Chance U, spelled Y-O-U, Tools, Tips, and Tough Love for Bringing Your A Game to Life. Brittany, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. My pleasure. So I'll be honest. I did not watch Last Chance U. I probably should have because it sounds like something I really would have been into. And thankfully, it's on Netflix, so it's still there for me to go back and watch.
Right.
So we will do that. Your story is very interesting because you were able to help. Well, let's do this first. Let's talk about your background. Where did you come from? How did you get to be the a counselor to college athletes?
So I'm from Mississippi.
Okay.
I'll throw that. That's a state, by the way.
It's not people, just a river?
There's some people that are like, what's that? So that's a state. It is, I guess, known because it's the poorest state in our country and often right. gets some pretty bad press, sometimes rightly so. But so I lived my whole life in Mississippi, and I didn't know what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. I didn't have it all figured out. Still don't.
Right.
Most days.
Do any of us?
No, exactly. Exactly. So I'm honest about that right up front. But I kind of stumbled into the career. I graduated with a degree in sport communication after an advisor told me that I shouldn't major in that because I was a girl and wouldn't be able to get a job in sports. And I thought, well, it's the major with the least amount of math. So here I go and we'll see what happens. So I majored in that. And then I was getting my master's degree and needed it. My school paid for it, honestly. And the athletic director at the time said, we have one graduate assistantship left and it's in the athletic academic office at Mississippi State University. And I said, okay, I'll take it. Having absolutely no idea what that department did or that it even really existed. And within about 2 weeks of watching a very strong, successful woman really dive in and help these athletes navigate life off the field, academics, but then academics is never really about academics. So it becomes you're a counselor for all things. After watching her for about 2 weeks, I knew this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And so from that moment on, I have about a 15-year career working for an institution, for colleges and universities as an academic counselor. And then the last 2 years of my career at an institution, Netflix did a two-year documentary series on our program called Last Chance U.
So you mentioned Mississippi and being the poor state in the union. But your story is resonating to me because, you know, JUCO athletes are typically athletes oftentimes, not typically, are oftentimes athletes who don't come from resources, who don't have the money just to, you know, go to a D1 school and try to be a walk-on. And they might not have the academics to get into that D1 school in the first place. And they need to go, and if they really want to continue on with their athletic career, their pathway is through junior colleges or community colleges, that kind of thing. So what you're describing in Mississippi is junior college athletic life all over the United States. And I'm sure that if a school doesn't have someone like a Brittany Wagner on staff to help their students, they gosh darn sure wish they did. So that story is pretty remarkable. And as a girl dad, hearing you say, I took it because I was told I couldn't, it's like my heart just like beats broadly with that.
Yeah.
So what were your challenges being a woman counselor to athletes who probably don't have that type of figure in their life when they first meet you?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many challenges. The challenge with being a female college athletics was that I was often the only female in the room. You're working with not just the athletes, but you're working with coaching staffs and with an administration that is all male most of the time. And so I walked in every meeting as the lone female. And I think that I was also a single mom. And so I had this, I think being a female, being a single mom, having lived my whole life in Mississippi, I had this different perspective. For me, it was not just about winning. For me, it was that these were people, and it wasn't just touchdowns and tackles. It wasn't what was the fastest, easiest way to get us to a championship. It was, how can we get a championship? Yes, that's important, but how can we build something that's sustainable where we're actually building men? We're looking at our players as human beings, and we're forming more than just an athlete here. And oftentimes I was alone in that fight. And so there would be, whether it was a small decision or a large decision, I was often the only person in the room fighting for doing things, whether the right way or doing things that where we were looking at benefiting the athlete long-term, which may mean sacrificing athletically short-term. And that is not a popular opinion in an athletic department. And so I was fighting a lot of battles alone a lot of times.
Well, and I get that so much. And people always focus on what are the challenges of being a woman in that environment. So let me flip that script for a second. What were the benefits of being a woman in that environment? Because you bring a different set of something to the table. What was the best part of that? Because I'm sure that there was some things in your background that helped you.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, that we have the perspective of being the odd man out, of being the underdog, and we do bring that unique perspective. I also think that women, although we are blamed a lot of times for being more emotional, you know, we're blamed for being the emotional one in the relationship. I think a lot of times women have the ability to sit back and really, really listen to the room. And when we do speak, we're speaking with some thought, some confidence. And so I had the ability to kind of walk in a room and read the room. And then I would sit quietly until, you know, everyone out, the screaming and the shouting and the, you know, muscle flexing was over. And then you bring a different perspective. And sometimes it was emotional sometimes, but I think that I took it personally because it was personal, because these were people that we were dealing with. And I think a lot of times, you know, the men that I would work with would have the ability to just cut all the relationship aspect out of it. And they would look at black and white numbers. Whereas I think females have a better ability to look at the gray in the issue and kind of work through the gray and work through the relationship aspect of what you're dealing with.
Sure.
You know, I'm 5'4" and I worked with 6 foot, you know, men who were big former football players. And then these athletes who are humongous human beings. And I would notice an intimidation factor with the men. They would stand kind of toe to toe with me because it gave them the ability to look down. And it was an intimidation factor by a lot of the men that I worked with. And I caught on very quickly. And so you never see me. If you watch Last Chance U, I am always in about 4-inch heels, because that was a strategy of mine to gain some height and some prestige. It gave me some confidence so I could walk in a room and feel like I had a presence. I was very, very deliberate in how I dressed, how I presented myself in these meetings, and always trying to be taller than I really was. No one knew I was short because I was always wearing heels.
Right, right. And one other thing you mentioned, and I think it's so important because, you know, the vast majority of college athletes never make it to a pro level. I mean, that's just the fact, especially when you're talking junior college. You know, they might not even make it to the D1 level. So, you know, and the coaches who really get it are the ones who are striving to win, but understand their number one job is to create good human beings. and to provide them with the skills they need when they're no longer in that team environment, to provide them with those skills that they need when they get into the business world. And maybe now they're the leader because they have this team building background. And that's the best thing that any coach or counselor can give to a young athlete, because most of them are going to be moving on to something having nothing to do with athletics, right?
Right. Yeah. You know, research shows that 1% of college athletes make it to the NFL. And actually, even when they make it to the NFL, there's a average of three year longevity. And so, you know, you don't see, other than Tom Brady, you're not really seeing 40-year-old football players.
Right.
But the money that they're making, unless they are Tom Brady, isn't going to sustain them through their 80s and 90s. It's not in today's society, even though it's a big million-dollar figure, for them to live the lifestyle that they usually live, that money is not going to last them, you know, until they die. And so there has to be some other options out there. And I think that it's also important to me. It was always important to me because so many of the young men that I worked with had been told over and over and over again that they weren't going to be good at anything else. They weren't good enough to be good at anything else. You're not smart enough. You're not good enough. This is your only way out, is through this ball. And so when you hear that over and over and over again, you believe it, and you really start to believe that your only avenue in life, the only thing you can ever do, is catch a football or tackle someone who's holding the football. And for me, it was really important to flip the mental note, you know, to flip the talk and to say, that's a lie. Like, you do have the ability to be good at something else. You are more than an athlete. You've never tried, you know, you've never put eggs in another basket because you've always believed this was your only avenue. And so whether they had an opportunity to go to the NFL or not, I still wanted you to believe that you could be good at something else and that you had the ability to do something else, that you were smart. That confidence and that belief in yourself, I think, is important no matter what you're doing.
So we're going to get to mindset, because that's really where I wanted to dig with you. And that's what your book's about, is helping people with their mindset. But before we do that, for those folks who haven't been able to see the show, can you just share with us one story of someone who you connected with, someone who you thought may have been going down a bad path, someone who had that idea that football was the only thing for them and you were able to help them get past that and where they are today? Can you give us one anecdote?
Yeah, I think the guy from the show that everyone loves is Ronald Ollie. His name is Ronald Ollie. He was from a tiny town, Shibuda, Mississippi, which is in Kemper County, Mississippi. Kemper County, at the time that we filmed the show, was the second poorest county in the United States. So it's poverty like most of us have never really seen. And when Ronald was 4 years old, 4 or 5 years old, he witnessed his father shoot his mother and then turn the gun and shoot himself.
Oh.
And so as a very young child, he was traumatized, obviously, but and also parentless, and really had no... nothing, you know, everything, the little that he had before was all of a sudden taken completely away from him. And so the rest of his life, he lived with different relatives and was kind of shuffled around. He picked up a football at some time shortly after his parents passed away and just started honing all of his, you know, anger and everything he had into this sport. And he struggled a lot academically. He had post-traumatic stress disorder and had problems sitting still in a classroom and had some behavior issues. And so he found himself with one scholarship offer out of high school, and it was to East Mississippi Community College. And he took it and he came, and you see him on the show, season one of the show, you see him his sophomore year when a relationship has developed between the two of us. And there's a scene, though, where he says to me, and in the show, he says, "I hated you." And I said, "I know you hated me. That's okay." And he said, "I don't hate you anymore." And I said, "I know." And his freshman year, he got there and he was testing the waters. You know, he was testing what he could get away with. He was testing who was going to stick by him and who was going to abandon him. I mean, he was struggling to make the right decisions his freshman year. And then you saw him his sophomore year, the connection that he and I made and the relationship that we had, the bond that we formed, you saw him really start putting forth effort. and you watch him form a bond with me and his English teacher. You watch him come to tutoring and work his tail off, and you see him at the end of season one skipping down the hallway as he's made an A in his college English class, which affords him the opportunity to play Division I football, which in a case like his, it's more than a football scholarship because it's two more years of a roof being over your head, free food, an education that you would not otherwise get. It's two more years of safety and security of your life, honestly. And so for him, and there were so many guys just like him that I worked with over the 15 years, but for him, that football scholarship, it is so much bigger. It is the difference in life or death and success or failure, because it's affording you time.
Right.
And you wouldn't get that otherwise.
So where did he go D1 football? Where did he play?
He played at Nicholls State University in Thibodaux, Louisiana.
Okay.
Then he actually was signed as a free agent with the Raiders.
Okay.
And got cut several times in the NFL, and then ended up with a CFL offer this after COVID opened the CFL back up. He had a CFL offer and went to Canada and had an opportunity to see Canada and play for them for a while and got hurt. And so he's in Houston, Texas right now. He's actually working with young athletes at a training facility there and is doing fabulous, but yeah.
So it's hard to speculate. Okay. Where would he be today without you?
You know, I don't know. And sometimes I struggle with giving myself too much credit. And I think, you know, somebody else, maybe if it weren't me, it would have been somebody else, or maybe that all the light bulbs would have gone off and he would have, you know, figured it out without me. I don't know. I don't want to give myself too much credit there, but I also think without anybody, I don't know, you know, there needed to be somebody in his life. And I was the person that was put in front of him.
I guess that would have probably been the better way to look at that is where would he be without somebody like you? And I think people should think about the effect they can have on other people just by taking a few more minutes, just by listening a little bit more and thinking about what, you know, just regular folk can do to help other folks and to open your mind to the idea that maybe you have just a tiny bit of advice or maybe you're the right person to listen at the right time, and how that can have just a monumental effect on people's lives. It's just so interesting to hear that story, and I'm sure you've got many, many, many more like that that you can tell. And I'm sure there are other people out there who've had that same effect on youngsters in different ways throughout their lives.
The book is Next Chance You. When we come back, more with Brittany Wagner.
Welcome back to Let's Talk. Our guest today, Brittany Wagner. So let's flip a little bit here to mindset. You've taken your experience on the show. You've taken it to write a book. You've also been able to connect with lots of other people, some of which are big name folks. I'm looking at your testimonials on your website. You've worked with Courtney Cox and Lance Bass, and you know, these are folks that we've all heard of before. Lots of football players. If you're a country music fan, Sarah Evans. I love Sarah Evans. And so you've been able to take your success, and instead of just saying I'm going to pat myself on the back, I was on Netflix, and you're now still continuing to help people. And with mindset, I had an issue with mindset right before COVID. I was laid off from a job. I was trying to work into something else. And I spent 30 years as a journalist, and I was trying to work my way into a completely different career in financial services. And I'm not a salesperson at all, but I had to say to myself that I can do this. Why can't I do this? How, you know, why should I be, why am I different than anyone else? And it took me digging deep into lots of mindset books and YouTube videos and podcasts. Why is it that people get put themselves into a lane and aren't able in many cases to change lanes, especially when you're 50 years old and late in life.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a, I use the example of country dirt roads when I'm speaking a lot of times. And because I live in Alabama now, I grew up in Mississippi, and down here in the South, you know, we have these old dirt roads, and they're just country dirt roads. And you get big trucks that drive down the dirt roads, and those tires form divots and ruts in the road. And then it rains, and you drive them, and the divots get deeper and deeper and deeper. And it gets to the point where you kind of have hands-free steering. I mean, you can turn on the road and not hold on to the steering wheel, and the truck is just going to go into the rut and drive itself down the road. And our brain is the same way. Mm. It's the neuroplasticity of the brain. We have the ruts in our brain that are our behaviors, that are our habits. And so we just go on autopilot a lot of times. When things get hard, when things get tough, when we get stressed, we form that, we just drive ourselves right into that rut that is the behavior that we know. And a lot of times for us, some of those behaviors are formed as a child when we are in traumatic situations, when we're just trying to cope. And so the behaviors may not be the best thing for us as an adult. This is how addiction forms. This is how, you know, we all have a vice, whether it's shopping, eating, alcohol, whatever it is, we all have one. And so it's that rut of our brain. And what it takes is grabbing the steering wheel and intentionally forming a different rut. It takes work and effort to get the truck out of autopilot, to get our bodies and our minds out of autopilot and start doing something different intentionally. And you can't break an old habit without forming a new habit. But what happens is when people are looking for the magic wand, you know, they're looking for the diet pill that they can take and swallow. Right. And then within a day they lose 10 pounds. They're looking for that quick fix. And so they want to change the rut. Nobody wakes up wanting to be a failure.
Right.
So we wake up and we want to do better. We want to be better. But then when we realize there's no quick fix and we have to actually grab the wheel and do something to form a different habit, you know, we're out within about 5 minutes or 5 days, or, you know, there's right. a timeline where we stop the process and we don't ever allow ourselves to be successful in the new habit. So then we default back to the old habit and we never really create the change.
Right. I tell people it's comfort and fear, comfort and fear, comfort and fear. You know, there's a reason why we have comfort foods. There's a reason why we like to wear the same pair of shoes every day, because breaking in a new pair of shoes hurts. You know, there's a reason why most people eat the same 10 or 15 foods every day for 345 days out of the year. You know, sure, they might go to a restaurant and eat something new once or twice, or maybe they'll get, a wild hair up their butt and make a new dish on a Saturday or Sunday night. But most people, if you go in their pantry and you go in their cabinet and you and in the refrigerator, and if you look at it once a month, every month for a year, you're going to find the same stuff in their pantry, in the refrigerator, in their freezer every time you look, because it's comfortable to them. They know what they're doing, and they don't want to get out of that because there's a fear factor. And doing things that are different, doing things that make you turn out of those ruts, you don't know where the truck's going to go when you turn out of that rut. And you know, it's so hard for people to get used to that. So what's the strategy? You know, what's the strategy? Obviously, there might be a dead end and then you have to turn at the off the ruts. But what if there is no dead end? And that's an ever-long road, but you know you need to do something.
Well, I think there's always a dead end. if the behavior is destructive behavior, at some point, I talk in the book about a pebble, a brick, a stone. Like you can keep you can keep up the same behavior, and a pebble's going to get thrown, and then when that doesn't wake you up, the brick, and then eventually you're going to get clocked with a stone, and there's going to be a serious consequence here. So it's at what point? At what consequence is the cost outweighing? You know, outweighing the benefit here. I think the key for me, I had an athlete one time who had come from homelessness, and here he was, you know, with a college scholarship, and I was having a hard time getting him adjusted. And he came in one day and said he was going to quit. And I thought, well, that's crazy because you're homeless, you know? And so I said, well, and go back to what? And he looked at me and he said, and go back to what I know.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I know how to do that. I know what time the restaurants dump the food in which dumpsters. I know what time to dumpster dive and how to get to the dumpsters. I know what side of the street to walk on at certain times of the night. I know what avenues to avoid. Like, I've got that figured out. And as dangerous as it may seem to you, I'm comfortable in that environment. I'm not comfortable in this environment where I walk into a cafeteria and all the food's laid out in front of me. You want me to walk down the hall a certain way and sit in a desk a certain way. And this is so uncomfortable to me. So I think the key is for those of us trying to make an impact is to create environments and spaces that are comfortable, not for ourselves, but for the people that we're trying to impact. And we have to realize that, you know, language and attitude and actions and expectations are intimidating for people who aren't used to that box. And so to stop with the one size fits all expectation and to really look at who you're trying to impact and meet them where they are, and then grow them from there, I think is important. It's important to make the space as comfortable as you can for the person so that they will at least put forth effort to try. You're not going to get anywhere with them if it's so intimidating from the get-go that they won't even put forth effort to try.
I think two things are really key in that. First of all, understanding that it's okay to think about and ask questions about other people's experiences. Because you just said something that I never would have hit me, that I would have thought, wow, this kid's got this chance. He's no longer homeless. He would just like be diving into it. And I never once would I have thought that that would be terrifying to someone or could be, you know, and I'm sure that different people would take that in a different way, too. You know, that maybe not every kid who would come to you who came from homelessness would have that same reaction. Maybe right. Another kid came from homelessness, but for 5 years before that or 10 years before that, they lived what we all would kind of consider a more normal life. And they're like, oh, I want to just slide right back into that. But you had the forethought to ask that question, to wonder, what is this person's experience, and to go there. And then the idea that this one size fits all is such a big deal. My daughter goes to a performing arts school, and it's very interesting. Once we got to this school that's so focused on performing arts, we still wanted her to have a great academic experience. And we couldn't understand right at the start why she started excelling more academically after getting to the performing arts school. So I started asking some questions, and her teacher, one of them said to me, well, arts kids learn differently than other kids. There's different ways to teach different types of kids. So kids who are science brainiacs learn one way, kids who are literary people learn another way, and kids who are creative learn a whole different way from that. And all of the teachers at this school have taken the time to learn how to teach arts kids, you know, and thankfully we're in a position where we can send her to a specific place for what she loves. But you go to places, lots of places in this country, those opportunities don't exist, you know? And so I think about all the kids who are left behind because they're trying to be pushed into this one size fits all bucket that doesn't fit for probably 2/3 of the people in the bucket.
Exactly. And we public education, in my opinion, is the absolute worst at that. Is, you know, we have this one size fits all model for how people learn, even though we know that there's auditory learners, visual learners, kinesthetic. We know this, we have this knowledge, but we don't apply the knowledge in the classroom because, in my opinion, it costs too much money and it takes too much work. And we're not interested in either one of those. So we want the kids to then adapt to our laziness and to learn the way that we want them to learn. And that's why we lose 50% of our population in public education, because they can't. Their brains aren't wired that way. And then you take kids, you add on to that kids with trauma.
Right.
And the way the brain copes with trauma, you add on to that kids that are that have, you know, think about a third grader coming to school and sitting in a desk and being expected to take a math test when he hasn't eaten in 3 days. He's doesn't know where his mother is. He's been abused. I mean, you can't, the social and emotional needs of these kids have to be met in order for them to have the capacity to learn at the same rate as kids who don't have that kind of trauma in their life.
Right.
But we don't ask the questions. And I think a lot of times in schools, we don't give our teachers the opportunity to know each individual kid because we're too concerned with teaching to the test and test scores and funding. And so we're not allowing our teachers to do what they do best and to do what drew them to the profession in the first place. And that is form a relationship with their students in order to really impact their lives. We're not interested in it. And we're failing miserably in public education because we won't take this into consideration.
And a perfect example of this is when you go to look at a high school, the thing that they always tell you is, what percentage of students went to college? That's the statistic they give you. They don't tell you which percentage of kids went to a trade school.
Right.
They don't tell you which percentage of students graduated from school and ended up with a job.
Right.
You know, they're measuring every student in that school, regardless of what their backgrounds, their needs, or their wants are, by whether or not they got to college. And not everybody is college needs college. You know, I'm a believer that anybody who wants to go to college is capable of doing it for the most part. But that because people are capable of going to college doesn't necessarily mean it's the best place for them or even what they want to do. So we're measuring all of our schools by, did the kids go to college? And that's putting, again, so much emphasis on the testing or whatever the process is to get them there that it takes away from the idea. And I get it. There are schools with 2000 high schools with 2000 kids in it. You know, and it's hard to individually tailor everything for 2000 separate kids, but there must be ways to be able to have maybe four or five different tracks that we can put the people in. At least now you're not putting 2000 kids into one bucket. Now you're trying to figure out which of the five buckets do they belong in. So it's so important to have it, the ability to be able to do that.
Yeah. And we measure college entrance by a test score. So we're measuring high schools by how many kids went to college, and we're measuring which of those kids can go to college by how they perform one day on a Saturday morning for a 4-hour ACT or SAT test.
Right.
When we're not taking, yes, we're all taking the same test, but we're not all taking it under the same conditions.
Right. Well, the good news is that's starting to change. In California, there are no more standardized tests being used to determine who goes to college in the state schools. So, and I have a feeling that that will be something that more and more states or university systems will start to go to down the road. There's just too much inequity in that testing. And it doesn't matter whether you're in California or you're in Mississippi or you're in New York or you're in Massachusetts, you know, there are inequities and there's no way to doubt that. There's been court rulings now that have shown that. I think California went there because they were going to be forced by a court to go there. However, it happened, it's happened. And while they've said it's going to be temporary, I don't see them going back now. It's just too tough. And I think that's a good place to go. So a couple things, because we are having a fantastic conversation that at some point in time is going to have to come to an end. And I'm just having so much fun with this. There's a movie coming out and Courtney Cox is going to play you in the movie.
Yes, it is a scripted TV show. So okay. It'll be a series that will stream on a streaming network, but it'll be a series about my experiences, my personal and professional life in Mississippi and in working with these athletes. And Courtney Cox will be playing me in that series. Michael Strahan is also an executive producer on that project. So
did they just come to you after seeing Last Chance You and say, you know, your story is compelling, we should do this?
Yes, pretty much. It's that day when you open up your email and you have an email from like Michael Strahan and you're going, this got to be a joke. Like somebody, you know, just stole his name and made up an email address and there's no way this can be real. And then you get on the conference call and you hear Monica on the other end of the phone and you're like, wait a minute, this is real. So yeah, it's happening.
So when you're on that phone call, you probably shouldn't say that Phoebe was your favorite friend.
Well, interestingly enough, Phoebe's aunt is involved in the project too. So she works for Strahan's team. And so she was one of the first people that I met, actually.
Oh, that's amazing.
But yeah, no, Monica and I are two, we are very similar. Our personalities are very similar. So there's no denying that Monica was my favorite character.
Well, and I can see that she was the go-getter of that group, and you certainly have that same personality. Any idea when that's going to be able, you know, get going and on the air yet, or is it still in development?
It's in development. COVID put it to a screeching halt, and so we have just ramped back up. So hopefully we will not be stopped again.
All right, so let's get to the book. If I buy the book, which I have right here, I'm going to hold it up. It's a podcast. Nobody will know I'm holding the book up. Okay. But I'm holding up the book because this is a podcast. I know I'm Polish. I'm working my way around this. But if I get the book and I dig into this, this is a 1 or 2 plane flight book. Mm-hmm. I'm getting ready to get on a plane this weekend. This is my homework this weekend. What am I going to get from the book?
You're going to get some motivation and inspiration. To believe in yourself, to believe in the notion that we're never on our last chance. We're not stuck. We think we are. Sometimes we feel stuck. The feelings that we feel are real and need to be acknowledged. It's the stories surrounding the feelings that oftentimes are not real. They're lies that we've made up, that we're telling ourselves, that we're focusing on. So the book is motivation and inspiration to say, you know what, if you woke up today, you have a next shot, a next chance at kind of getting it together and being your best self. The book is also not sunshine and rainbows. You know, I made sure it was in the subtitle, Tough Love, Tools, Tips, and Tough Love for Bringing Your A-Game to Life, because there is some tough love. I mean, there is some moments where, you know, I'm going to motivate and inspire you. And then I'm also going to challenge you to get up and do something about it. There are some sections at the end of each chapter. I'm a self-help guru. I love self-help books. I feel like I've read them all. What I dislike about a self-help book is I finish reading it and then I go, okay, well, now what? Like, I don't know how to apply any of this into my life. And so at the end of each chapter, there's a sharpen up section where I'm pretty much challenging you to do specific things to put into place what I've just told you about in that chapter. It is a very easy read on purpose. I know, you know, people that pick up a self-help book don't want to read through 400 pages of what they need to be doing. And so I tried to make it a quick read and simple and easy to do, and also motivational and inspiring.
It's great
stuff.
There's
stories of athletes, but there's also stories of my own life that have nothing to do with athletics. So it's pretty much a book that I feel like everyone could pick up and read through.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Where can we find the book?
It is everywhere where books are available, to my knowledge. So Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. You can get the Audible version. I narrate the Audible version, which was fun and hard at the same time. But you can download the Audible version and I will read it to you in my lovely Southern accent.
Fantastic. So, and this wasn't supposed to be part of our discussion here, but if you've got a company out there and you've got a corporate meeting coming up and you want someone to give a keynote, this last 30 minutes, I can tell you, Brittany would be fantastic for that. Go to brittanywagner.com. You can book her there for a speaking engagement. Your story and the way you tell it and the folks who you have had the opportunity to connect with and the lives that you changed and the lives that I'm sure you will continue to change for years to come is exciting. And I'm so happy to be just a tiny little cog in that gear of what you're doing. And if you have something new coming out, you know, get in touch. And I'd love to have you on again and talk with you about it. And because your stories are fantastic.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'll come back when the show's coming out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Maybe we can have you and Courtney come on together.
That would be
fantastic. We'll put that out there. So
yeah.
Thanks again. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking some time with us.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. That's going to do it for this week's episode of Let's Talk. If you like what you're hearing, subscribe to the Let's Talk podcast so you won't miss an episode. It would also be great if you leave a comment, especially if it's a good one. If it's a bad one, go find that someone else's podcast page and put it on there. You can follow us on social media to find out who our next guest is and leave a question on Twitter. It's Let's Talk with BB. You can find us on Facebook by doing a search for Let's Talk with Brian Bielanski. New Let's Talk podcasts drop every week. Have yourself a good week. Spend some time with interesting people, and we'll see you next time.